This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Jet fuel.
The academic stuff is great, and it's a great base to show, you know, that we've put some work into this. But really, you can discount that, because the important stuff is how do we map that to the problem that the customer has, and therefore the agencies and the rest of the kind of world has around it.
Welcome, everyone, to episode one of season three of the Fuel Podcast, the new business show. And I'm your host, a Smith called Keith. Last year was a huge growth year for the show. We managed 5,000 new listeners, and the quality of the guests was absolutely top draw. So, as a podcast dedicated to increasing the knowledge and highlighting the techniques used in creative agency sales and new business development, we're mining new depths and scaling great heights this year, and we've got a cracking show for you to kick things off. Cookies are coming off the menu, and the entire internet is going to have to find new ways to identify new customers. So we've done our research and found a pioneer of a solution that uses AI to help you increase sales. Now, this isn't just using the term AI as clickbait. This is genuine, boffin quality, science-led artificial intelligence, and you're going to be amazed at how it can be implemented by creative agencies to help their clients grow their business. So stick around. Now, 2022 is shaping up already to be as unpredictable as last year. We all thought this pandemic would be over by now, but new variants and a less than comprehensive vaccination rates and terrible political leadership have produced a patchwork of different economies. And what it all boils down to is that a significant amount of companies are reinforcing their working from home policies, so a lot of our clients and prospects are still working remotely. So, if you're going to identify and engage with them, you need all the tools that the best new business agencies use. Fuel is sponsored by The Advertist, a SaaS platform that helps anyone working in new business plan out and implement their keep in touch strategies using industry news, tenders, people moves, mergers and acquisitions, research and insight, married with a best in class contact database. It's all in one place for new business managers to design and execute one-to-one or one-to-many new business campaigns. The Advertist is just £1,500 for two people for 1 year's access to all the great features and functionality that help you win at new business. And it's run by a team of people who actually understand the pressures of creative agency sales. So give the team a call on 0203 356 3717 if you're in the UK, or simply email hello at theadvertist.com. That's theadvertist.com for more information, and get yourself a free trial of the agency world's leading new business development tool, The Advertist. Now, on with the show. And before we dive into the main event this week, we welcome back Jeremy Davies, who's got some advice for any agencies out there who've made new business New Year's resolutions.
Jeremy Davies!
There are two things that everyone knows about New Year's resolutions. The first is that no one keeps them, so they're a little bit like political party election manifestos, or indeed creative agencies that say they will never do free pitches. The second thing everyone knows about New Year's resolutions is that they should be vague and faintly unrealistic, and so ambiguous you might have read them in the Daily Mail horoscope page, with no hint of a plan or roadmap as to how to achieve them. This is one reason why we feel we can get away without keeping them. In that respect, they're a pretty good analogy for the average agency's new business plan, many of which are packed full of the inspiration that comprises 10% of successful new business development without committing to the perspiration that makes up the other 90. Much like the well-known New Year's resolution cliche of joining a gym in January and then not going for the rest of the year. At this time of year, there are inevitably all kinds of lists being published of New Year's resolutions for marketing and new business people. With so much talk in marketing and new business of data, insights, and the sort of meticulously researched and costed thinking that will persuade the C-suite to take us seriously, it's heartening to see that the traditions of New Year's resolutions are being upheld. A blog post in early December features on pixel.com, a site to which I confess I had hitherto paid scant attention, features such fine examples of the sort of detail-free undertakings that one might commit to it just after midnight on the 1st of January after too many glasses of bubbly, such as adopt emerging technologies and try new trends and strategies, timeless aphorisms that could come from any GCSE-level marketing textbook, as well as the reliable fallback, become a better listener, which could just as well feature in any generic set of New Year's resolutions that have nothing to do with our profession. There are, of course, two sides to any agency new business plan. The lofty objectives passed down from the board, to come back to that 10% inspiration, and the grunt work required to get somewhere close to achieving them. The first part, those targets passed down from on high, are probably more like the sort of wish list you might find in a letter to Father Christmas, just to keep things topical, than in a list of New Year's resolutions, and with similar levels of expectation of getting any sort of response from the target audience. The other side of the coin, the donkey work required to generate opportunities with that wish list, are more analogous to traditional New Year's resolutions in that they generally feature lots of shiny new ideas as to how to increase the effectiveness of lead generation activities and a commitment to reinventing the wheel, which, if you'll pardon the mixing of metaphors, runs out of steam within a few weeks of going back to work. And we all end up back on the phone, having realised that, hey, actually talking to people, sometimes even in listening to them, is a really effective business development technique. So, whether your New Year's new business plan involves a flashy new toolkit or innovative new techniques, just think of it like joining a gym. All those shiny machines may look better when they aren't dripping in sweat, but without the perspiration, the inspiration goes flat very fast.
Welcome back to the first Fuel podcast of 2022. How's those New Year's resolutions holding up? Hope you managed to keep them going so far. And it's appropriate that I mention giving things up because that's what this show is all about. Something that we're all being forced to give up and the solution that lies with today's guest. Because we had such great feedback on last year's Splendid Shows that in season three, we've decided to double down on our chats with expert agency solutions. And this one is something that every single creative agency is going to have to tangle with this year. It's probably the single most important element of the new business and marketing process. How do you recognise or identify a new customer? Globalisation has delivered a load of benefits with borderless digital trading and customer communication, of course, but let's talk about the elephant in the room, those elephant-shaped cookies that the tech industry seems to have an addiction to. Quick recap, cookies are the data used to track users online. They're little packets of data that are set up on a user's computer when they first visit a website, and they allow web browsers to save information about the session. So it's the box that kind of pops up when you visit a website that contains all sorts of loads of fine print, but we all have to just click OK or accept without giving it a further moment's notice. Unfortunately, this strategy has also opened up a can of worms, resulting in customers who either feel spied on due to hyper-personalized recommendations or who become frustrated by poor recommendations based only on their age or gender. Apple, Amazon, Google, and Facebook have all been walloped with huge fines for using cookies in breach of EU regulations, and data privacy law enforcers are growing an impressive set of teeth. So we're about to say goodbye to them. We've got to give them up. Which brings me on to the other elephant in the room, which is makes it quite a crowded room. We've now got two elephants and a can of worms. The cold start problem, where businesses don't have the right technology to deliver truly personalized online experiences for new or anonymous users. If you don't have the information on a customer's past purchases or preferences, how are you going to deliver a truly personalized experience? This isn't just a consumer sales problem, it's also B2B. And another consequence of this ongoing pandemic is that companies are all scrambling for new business and ways to find new customers. A change in mindset is necessary and we need to embrace it as an opportunity. And guess what? My guest this week has got a solution. His solution is both simple and so clever that, to quote Blackadder, you could pin a tail on it and call it a fox. Tom Ridges is the CEO of Geodata Labs, or GD Labs, a targeting platform that can analyze sales data to predict where your next best customers are. Tom is a solutions architect. His CV reads like a history of blue chip technology with tenures at Attendo, Rackspace and Microsoft. GD Lab is positioned to help you and your customers give up the old cookie addiction and replace it with a far healthier, more logical and intelligent solution using the very latest technology. I met Tom through a chat with the show's good friend Lucy Snell at Cherry Business Development, who also tipped me off to Tom's company because, as she told me, this issue is going to affect each and every one of us and there's no avoiding it. But don't worry, because Tom's here to tell you how it all gets solved, and that's where we need to get solved by. So welcome to the show, Tom Ridges.
Hey, welcome, Keith. Thanks for the intro. I love it. Yeah, I'm really excited about this. I think, you know, since we spoke a few weeks back, actually the conversation we had then was full of energy, and actually having the opportunity to get under the skin of this issue, I think it's going to be, yeah, a good conversation.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it. And obviously it's the first one of the year, and I've been quite excited about it. Plenty of time to think about it. And I mean, just before we start, I mean, I've got to say, you're also a podcaster, right? You've got your own show. So let's give that a quick plug before we start. What's that called?
Yeah, great. It's called Data for Bluffers. So what we wanted to do, you know, there's a lot of serious stuff in the B2B world, right? And we really wanted to put something out there that kind of showed how do you deal with the concepts and the terms in data, but in a lighthearted way, right? So they're 20 minutes long. You know, we tackle concepts such as what's an algorithm, what is data science, right? But in 20 minutes, aimed for sort of marketers or growth teams, you know, we try and hopefully we succeed, but we try and sort of break down the industry lingo that gets used and the confusing nature in a way. And it's me and you know, our head of data science. And we just have a conversation about these topics to make it easy for people. So it's available on all the usual platforms, you know.
Perfect.
Apple, Spotify. So yeah, check it out.
Lovely. And so how long have you been doing it?
Not long, actually. We started it in November. So okay. we're kind of really new to it.
Excellent. Yeah, you're enjoying it?
Part of the business. Love it. Yeah, love it. You know, we appeared on another podcast probably about 8 weeks ago now. We recorded it 8 weeks ago. And you know what? It was just so much fun actually digging into the issues, explaining the concepts. And actually on that podcast, you know, we were talking to some marketers. We realized we kind of take for granted the level of data that we work with, right? And there's actually lots of questions over just the simple concepts in data, right, that get misused every day. And we thought, you know what? It's great fun and there's a good opportunity to, you know, to kind of explain that to the masses, but try and use marketing and growth examples, right? Try and bring the context back to the audience that we work with, as opposed to just using generic examples.
Yeah, and I think it's important, isn't it? Because we're all guilty of it, but we all kind of get lost in our own jargon, and I think it can be quite confusing sometimes. So it's often good, and as I think a podcast is a great kind of platform to kind of bring everything down to a sort of a decent level so that everybody can access it. But well, good luck with that, and. We'll give you all the details in the show notes for the podcast anyway. But so before we dive straight in, and just so, like we said, just so everybody gets on the same page, there's a few terms that Tom's going to mention, and so just so we get the terminology right, first, second, third party data. First is stuff like a website, right? Like CRM, social media, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, I break it down into, really, it's data that you collect or data that someone else collects, right? So you could be collecting data from your website, but it could be through your sales process. First party data is data that you are collecting. Third party data is data that someone else has collected. Now, what people have started to do in between that has sort of slice it up a bit. So second party data has come in. Really, that's data that's come from someone else, but you've got a bit more trust to them.
That's almost like I didn't mean to jump in all over you there, but that's almost like a Hertz with Virgin Airlines or something, you know, where they're sort of sharing the same sort of data. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. It's that, you know, someone's also come along with zero party data, right? It's people data that people are valuing. And really for me, I kind of focused on, you know, for the sake of ease, if you like, for people, is always first party data is data that you've collected as an organization. Third party data is data that someone else collected that you're using. And then second is a form of third, if you like. It's kind of a ranking from that. But if you're clear with first and third, you can't really go far wrong.
Excellent. All right. And okay, so the cookie business, getting rid of it. I mean, what's the timeline we all got to work to? Who's eliminating cookies and by when?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. There's a lot of noise been made about it because, you know, Google have made a lot of noise that they're going to block it from the Chrome browser. So, you know, the reason it got so much noise from Google is because Chrome has, you know, 60-70% of the market share, right? So it's a big thing. Safari and Firefox actually have already got rid of cookie support. Like, they've already blocked them, and they did that as of 2019, okay? It was actually supposed to be about now. January 22, Google said they were going to get rid of the cookies. Towards the middle of last year, they changed that and pushed it back. So we've now got till some point near the end of 2023. So we've got a bit of time.
Ooh, okay.
But fundamentally, it's already being blocked. And also, if you think outside cookies, I don't know if you're an iPhone user, Keith, but
I'm an Android sort of person.
Cool. So on the iPhone, now when you install apps, you get the prompt for tracking. You know, this app wants to track you. Do you want to or not? So, you know, Apple are also rolling out, while not directly related to cookies, it's totally related to tracking users. You know, they're giving the users real easy opt-in choice of whether they want these apps to track them. And, you know, people are saying no.
So, and it's sort of a double-edged sword, isn't it, really? Because we all think we're really smart by saying, no, we don't want cookies and things like that. But then when we show up at a retail site or something else like that, and they're trying to sort of sell us stuff that we're not interested in, then we get annoyed about that. So, I mean, there has to be a kind of balance there, doesn't there?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, there's a big conversation there, you know, around advertising. You know,
is
I personally don't think advertising is bad, right? It's how we find out about things that are going to be useful. We all buy products to enhance our lives, and you want relevant ads. But at the same time, I think people are, you know, we're getting wary and bored of being spied on, right?
Yes.
Because, you know, there's the old adage, you know, if it's free, you're the product, you know. And unfortunately, we are the product, and we don't know how we're being used as a product. I think that's the fundamental problem, which makes us all feel a bit uneasy. I think if it was really clear how our data was being used, people might be a bit more
open to it.
But I just don't see that.
I mean, is there any data that shows just how good cookies have been? I mean, what a great idea they were in the first place. I mean, is this just a lot of fuss about nothing?
Yeah, that's probably quite a polarizing question. I think people on either side of the fence would probably have quite heated debates. I think what I always like to kind of think of at this junction is kind of third party data in its entirety, right? You know, you're ultimately buying data from a third party, and how much can you rely on the quality of it? You know, I was reading something from the B2B Institute, who put something out the other week, and there's been some studies that in demographic targeting of gender, that it's about 50% accurate, which made me laugh, right? Because me and you can take a guess. There's only, you know, you can be 50% accurate with a guess, right?
It's so, like, it may may not rain.
Well, exactly. So, you know, I just think, and I think, and they quoted like age targeting is 25% accurate. So I think, you know, I think the first, you know, we in digital advertising in this form has been going for nearly 30 years, and you know, we've got reliant on using third party data. And I think actually what this gives us a good time to look at is just the overall hygiene of third party data. You know, it's not all going to be bad, but I also think it's maybe not being considered. And this kind of brings it to the forefront of, well, actually, how good is third party data as a concept?
Right.
You know, it's not all created equal, let's put it that way.
Wow. So, I mean, so what alternatives to cookies, I mean, do sort of marketing sales departments have? And why should we be looking at them now?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I'll go first the selfishly with influence-based targeting.
Okay.
Right now, this is a kind of a new subcategory, if you like. But really what that is It's about identifying audiences that already have some affinity to your brand, right? Conversations happen. You know, people talk about products, yet they haven't yet bought it. So if you can identify these people or identify where they exist, you've got a better chance of activating them, right? So that I call influence-based targeting. Consent, right? You know, people are still going to opt in to be advertised to, right? So consent is still going to be a big thing going forward that is important. You know, we can have first party cookies on our website. We can ask people to opt in and we can then still target them. So that's not going to go away. Google themselves, they've proposed replacements. Flock, it's basically a cohort based advertising. So what they do is they say, look, Keith, you know, you're the sort of person that likes motorbikes and cats. You know, I don't know if you do, but
not then, bad, 50% right. Anyway.
Well, to be fair, I could see the cat on the on the thing behind, so that gave that one away.
Fair enough.
But what they do is they group you into like-minded cohorts, yep. Right? So they can still target, but they're just not able to identify who you are. And then the other grouping is sort of contextual-based advertising, right? So if you're on a shoe website, you know, you're going to see adverts for socks or shoe cleaner or whatever it might be. So there's options out there, and it's not, you know, there's not a silver bullet, right? I don't think in any sort of sales and marketing there's silver bullets. It's what are the new tools available, and when are they appropriate to use, and when are they appropriate to kind of combine?
Right. Right. Well, that makes sense. But I mean, I suppose given all this, you know, and as I said right at the start, you know, it's one of those things that, I mean, every company, every website you go to has a statement at the bottom, you know, cookies and privacy and all that sort of thing. I mean, I suppose this is, I mean, the first and most basic thing that's going to have to happen is that all these privacy pages are going to have to change as well, aren't they?
Not necessarily, because this isn't okay. A legislative change, right? That, you know, the rules have been put out. We've had, you know, in the UK and in Europe, we've had GDPR, right? So that's laid out how we need to deal with people's data. We already need to inform people of the cookies we're using and how what we're collecting. All this really is a tech company implementing, you know, their vision, if you like, for privacy. Now, what I would say is there's probably loads of privacy pages that aren't compliant with the standards, so they need to update. But as I say, this isn't about legislation change. What I do think is interesting, though, and I think it raises the topic. If we look at the public mood since, you know, what was GDPR 2018, you know, since then we've kind of had a rise of, you know, the consumer being more vocal about not being tracked. You know, we've seen protests, we've seen films being produced about it. So I think what's really interesting is we look forward, like the legislative pressure is increasing, right? So over the next 5-10 years, you know, it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect it to get kind of harder. So, you know, I think it's something we are going to have to contend with and work out in these privacy pages and how we set up our operating policies within the business of how we do operate in a more privacy-centric way. So actually building that thought process into how you're working now is I think, good practice for where the world's going.
Yeah, it's like you say, it's sort of good protocol to actually start thinking about those. Because, I mean, if you think about it, when we first started building websites and, you know, and e-commerce sites and stuff like that, the privacy side of it wasn't really the sort of foremost thing. I mean, it was just a question of getting the goods out there and getting them sold and burn and churn and all that sort of thing. But, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, as we've sort of matured, then it's a good idea to, you know, to make sure that customers are looked after in the same way that, you know, you walk into a store, you don't expect to be assaulted by people, do you? I mean, it's just normal good marketing sense.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, that's the other thing with cookies, right? You know, first party cookies add a lot to a user experience on a site, right? You know, these things aren't just used for tracking and advertising. You know, it can be used to give you a better user experience. So, sure. You know, it's not like cookies are evil. It's just if it's certain ways have been used, it's just not, I think people have just, you know, it's not how people want to work or want to be advertised to anymore.
No, it's a kind of a clumsy solution, but it was good for the time. But obviously now, you know, times they are changing.
And yes, they are.
You know, so I mean, as we are working in the world of new business, I mean, there's kind of a huge amount of sort of digital solutions that say that they're an alternative solution for identifying customers online, and specifically I'm talking about you, intent marketing. You tell me that a company's web searches tell us what they're looking for, but I mean, I don't find that a very convincing argument that based on what an entire company is looking through at Google on is a very good predictor of what a company is looking for in general. So, and I listened to a great show that you did, Tom, with your colleague Edmund recently, and because you sent me a preview copy of it, and well done. It's great, informative show, and I think that's out now anyway, isn't it?
It'll be out by the time this comes out. It's coming out Monday.
Right, okay, cool. And it's about this very subject. So obviously after you've listened to this, go listen to that one. And I don't want to get in too much in the sort of weeds about it, but I mean, if we can't have, you know, cookies, and we can't have surveillance marketing, and intent marketing is only good for as I think, as you said, for sort of best in show brands. I mean, what's the kind of real world practical solution that you guys have now developed?
Yeah, so I think, you know, you teed it up perfectly in the intro, right, that everyone is struggling to kind of find new customers. And if you look at a lot of people's, you know, media spend, once they've exhausted the traditional tactics, they're just witnessing, you know, they're witnessing diminishing returns, right, on their spend. Okay, so they're having to spend more and more and more to get less and less return, right? And then we see the rise of, therefore, people spending a lot more time focused on their existing customers, right? So they're not winning new logos, right? And that's the kind of problem that we see in the market. And really simply, if we go back to the last question when I talked about influence-based targeting, what we've basically built is a system that allows marketers to see the locations where audiences are likely talking about them and therefore have the highest chance of converting into a customer. Okay, so let me bring that to life, because that can seem a bit abstract. So let's say me and you are just talking about project management tools, Keith, right? And okay. I say Asana. Asana's a great tool. We use Asana, blah, 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 right? Now, by the simple very fact that we're having a conversation, Asana's now lodged in your brain, right, as a product that's probably worth checking out. Now, if you then see an ad for Asana, that reinforces that kind of link to Asana. Okay, so either when you're looking to buy project management software or someone asks you about your view on project management software, guess who's up in your head first?
Sure.
Right, Asana. Now, these conversations happen on Zoom calls, they happen on WhatsApp, they happen in the boardroom, they happen in the pub, right? So you can't, well, morally and legally, you can't track those, and neither would you want to. So what we've done is built a system that kind of goes after it, if you like.
That's amazing. And I mean, obviously, you know, the fact that you and I were talking about it, I mean, there is a kind of a recommendation element to it. And I think that's what I love about it. When you first explained it to me, you know, and if I understand it correctly, I mean, it's based on the, you know, that is the very principle that drives new business, which is recommendation and referral. I mean, you know, it's sort of increases the sort of transmission rate of a message. And so, I mean, the technology, the methodology is already proven. So, I mean, as a two-part question, how does it work, without obviously giving away the source here? I mean, how does it work? And I mean, because there must be a tremendous amount of white noise out there that's going to clutter up the whole thing. So, I mean, how does that sort of filter? I mean, is it effective in that kind of respect, that it can actually screen out all the sort of the white noise?
In short, how it works, and I'll cover the white noise piece, but what we're really doing is just looking for really subtle behavior signals, right? And that, again, sounds a bit like, what does that mean? The analogy I like to use is bush tracking, right? So, you know, if we were going out into the wilderness, okay, and there was one path, right, and I was trying to find you and you'd set off, you know, earlier in the day, as long as I'm going faster than you, I can follow the trodden path. Okay, right. So it's really easy to see you. Now, that's how we're traditionally tracking people, right? We've got a way to see them. Now, the impressive people in the wilderness are the bush trackers, right? They go out, there's no paths, and they'll see a leaf that's been kind of clipped or
broken,
a twig that's snapped, or a tree branch that's due's been knocked off, right? And they'll be able to sort of tell you what sort of thing has gone through there at what time, okay?
Wow. Yeah.
And that's kind of what we're doing. We're just not looking at trees and branches. We're looking at someone's sales data, right? And we're looking at the sales data and saying, right, what characteristics of this sale make it look like it's been influenced by another sale, right? And then what that allows us to do is identify those ones that we think are, and therefore that allows us to remove the white noise, right? And there can be up to like 75% noise in CRMs, sure. Right? There can be lots of bad data. So yeah, it's really about, we look for those signals and therefore we can make recommendations based on what we've seen.
That is so, and it's, I mean, this is AI, right? I mean, this is using artificial intelligence to do all this.
Yeah, it is. So, it's AI, but there are proprietary algorithms, so the guys in, there's a branch of science, if any of your listeners really want to geek out, it's called network science, right? There's a whole branch of science behind it, and what we've done is taken the principles in there, like the bush tracker, and we understand them, well, the guys understand them so well, we can now look for the hidden pieces, and we've built that into our own algorithms, and that allows us to build systems that can work really quickly, and we don't have to go through heavy-handed consultancy processes with every customer, right, which read heavy-handed as expensive, right? Because that's the whole consultancy world.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a very, very diplomatic way of putting it. But yeah, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, this is really next-gen, customer tracking or sort of sales predictive sort of stuff. It's super impressive. But let's just examine the impact on two types of sort of business here, which is big business and SME. Because obviously, I'm sure you read about it as well, but NBC Universal have created this NBC Unified solution. So, I mean, it's almost like a walled garden type approach where, they're doing it themselves. But not everybody's got these kind of NBC Universal size budgets, So, I mean, how does what you do help level the playing field for sort of smaller businesses?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good observation about, they don't have the budgets. And, when I, in the intro, you said I worked at Microsoft, one of the big trends we saw there was actually just access to data science resource, right? There's not enough data scientists out there, and the ones that do exist are very expensive. Okay, so
right.
You've got to have budget, but you've also got to have a brand to attract these resources in. Okay, and once you've got them there, you've got to have the leadership that know how to get the best out of them. Right, there's all these challenges of getting the best out of these teams.
Right.
So for the kind of the medium-sized businesses, what we've been able to do is produce a system that's, we're a SaaS platform, so it's one of these pay as you use. You're not having to hire, really expensive resource. It's come in and use it. And the other real really interesting piece there is, so many B2B data tools these days, you feel like you need an engineering degree to use them, right? There's 1,000 screens. They ask you to config, and then you're like, well, what's this giving me? It's giving me some pretty graphs, but what do I do? What we've really tried to do is almost take influence from consumer space, right? Something like, a Spotify is super easy to use because it's intuitive. And what we've tried to do is take that inspiration and say, well, look, you've given us your data, now go and do this, right? Wow. So rather than here's some pretty stuff to interpret, it's like, right, these are the locations, go and put these locations into LinkedIn by a click of a button. And then, because we're not a marketing company, we're a data analytics company, the great creatives in this world can continue doing their piece, but their ads they're loading into LinkedIn, for example, are fueled by our data, right? So it's how do we remove the cost out of it, but also the time, because let's face it, no one is looking sitting at their desk going, I wish I had another tool to use that took up loads of my time, right? It's how do we get in and how do we get out, and then and we refresh every month, right? So you get kind of a data set every month, and that's the other important thing, right? People aren't static, so when you buy a lot of these static data sets, you buy a data set that might be a couple of years old,
right?
Everyone else is buying it, right? So a lot of these shared data sets, if you're the first person to buy it, hoo-ha for you, because you know you've got a new data set. Once you're a customer 1,000 on that shared data set, it's probably started to lose some of its value. But actually, but that's what SMEs and mid-sized organizations generally have to do. But what we're saying here is we can give you a bespoke data set that's, that only works for you every month without having to invest in those teams, right? It's hopefully making it really easy for people to get to. And then the second side, like on the large side, actually, what's really interesting is, you know, having spent a lot of time, you know, working with data scientists and hiring data scientists, you kind of hear a lot of them work in these large organizations and criminally don't have enough to do, right? So they're sitting there twiddling their thumbs. You then see, you know, it's not uncommon to see marketing departments in these large organizations not necessarily getting access to the data science teams. So actually, you know, we get approached by, you know, some good-sized companies who you would say have their own analytics team, but the marketing team don't get access to them, right? So they want kind of, it's not, you know, one off the shelf solutions that give them that insight that they can just get moving with.
I love that. And so, I mean, what is the what would you say is the kind of level of information that a company needs to give you in so that you can let this system rip on it?
Yeah, I always have to break at this point and sort of. I think people shudder, right? When they hear about a data product, they get really excited. And then I think the thought that starts playing out in their head is like, oh, but how much data and where is it?
I've just got a spreadsheet.
Yeah. And like, I'm not sure I can pull all the different bits together. And yeah, we've been for years, you know, we've been brainwashed about big data, right? And big data is absolutely valuable. And for people that don't know the concept, it's lots of sort of unstructured data, right? So you might be taking all your social media posts, you might be combining that with your finance information or your CRM data. It's taking lots of data and trying to find signals and intelligence. And that's really useful and it has lots of pieces, but actually small data is really powerful, right? And the way we kind of talk about small data is it's typically a single data set that's, you know, and therefore by definition, they're easier to get to. And we thought, well, there's no point building a solution that is so data hungry that, you know, the businesses can't get hold of it, so therefore there's no value. So we purposely tried to do it on a small data set, right? So what we do is we look for companies' sales history. So we're looking for where have you been successful today, right? So that typically comes out of a CRM system or a payment system. Within that, we don't actually need too much. I won't go into too much detail today, but yeah, we look at that. We look at that one set of data. History is the most important thing. Put that into our system. And then, yeah, we spit it out on the other side. So it's, again, hopefully back to that. No one's sitting around looking for jobs to do. You know, we're not saying, well, now you've got to go on a 6-month data cleaning project. You know, this is data that most businesses have access to.
So you can literally take most of the data that a lot of companies have these days and sort of, you know, just with a little bit of tweaking, you can probably make it work for them, right?
Yeah. Exactly that.
Amazing. And so what role do postcodes play in this solution? You know, and I mean, if so, I mean, how does that work in the B2B world?
Yeah, okay. So I think whenever we talk about any form of targeting, the first thing to remember is you need a target, right?
Right.
Whether that's advertising or you're shooting a bow and arrow, you've got to have something to aim at, right?
Sure.
So if you think about the way we largely do it today, is that target, you know, air quotes, is cookies. It's a line of code, right? So we're kind of following people around. So if you're going to stop using that method, you need something else to target, okay? And thankfully, mankind has been quite good and we have a physical geography. So that's kind of why we use it. So in effect, we're using geography as a proxy for the audience, okay?
Okay.
Now, you also then think on the next layer, conversations that happen with people generally have a geographic link, right? You know, I'm just outside London, you're in the US, you know, we've got geographies attached to that, so right. We can model it. So that's why we use geographies. But then that therefore means we have a targeting mechanism. So LinkedIn, for example, a digital ad platform, you can upload geographies into there, okay? So we can give you a list of postcodes and say these are the areas you should target. And you can do that on an online platform, but you can obviously use it for out of home advertising as well. So it's because you're using geography, it doesn't stop using any other any channel, if you like.
Right.
It just means you've got a way of targeting that's really going after the audience that that's likely to convert.
And I mean, does this work on an international basis as well? I mean, you're not limited by geography, I take it.
two answers. So we're a startup, so we're kind of fairly early in our journey. So the technology works globally, what we've built, but it's the kind of 90-10 rule, you know, a bit better than the 80-20 rule, in that we just have to do the regional mapping into different countries. So today we're kind of working with UK headquartered businesses, but you know, for example, we're talking to a couple of international customers, and it's like, well, look, let's get this embedded in the UK. And then we'll do that 10% for, you know, we've talked to people in North America and Japan. So short answer is yes, but unfortunately I always get told off for this. I'm a bit too honest sometimes. And, you know, I should just give the yes, we can do anywhere in the world answer.
Just but, say yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, unfortunately, because we kind of go after privacy and transparency, it tends to come out in everything.
Sure. No, absolutely. No, I understand. I mean, I appreciate the I appreciate that. So, I mean, you mentioned your sort of client base and stuff. So, I mean, what sort of customers do you typically sort of work with? Is there a customer profile for you?
Yes, there is. You know, so we kind of have, you know, we work quite well. We're kind of working more heavily with a sort of scale up market. Okay. Now, it's not to say it doesn't work for other sides of business, but typically the scale-ups have, you know, they've raised lots of money. They've tried all the existing, you know, the traditional tools, if you like, to kind of get scale and growth, but they're hitting these points of diminishing returns and then they're looking for innovation. So, you know, that works. And hospitality, interestingly, yes. You know, I think if you think about what's happened in the world in the last few years, right? You know, domestic travel has changed, you know, how people are working has changed, foreign travel has changed. So, you know, hotels, restaurants, these businesses that knew where their customers were coming, they knew the seasonality, they knew when was business season, they knew when they needed to get more domestic travelers. That's all changed, right? So they've now got to go and fill these premises, be that, you know, a restaurant, a bar, or, you know, a hotel, with new people, right? And they're just not used to going after them in this way. So, you know, that kind of works. So, you know, we focus most of our, you know, again, 80-20, majority of our work's in the B2B space. But, you know, we are doing some work in that, you know, that kind of hospitality or, you know, direct to consumer space on the kind of lower end as well.
It's interesting you say that as well, though, isn't it? Because the, you know, the hospitality industry has been turned on its head in terms of how it used to operate. So, you know, I can imagine that, you know, your sort of approach to this is going to be, you know, they're all going to be looking for new ways to generate, you know, to generate new customers and revenues and stuff. And I can see this being quite an interesting, you know, sort of option to go at. I mean, from start to finish, I mean, how long does it take to sort of get implemented? I mean, if I said to you, okay, this is absolutely fantastic, Tom, I mean, so when can I start and when can you get started? How long does it take to turn around?
Yes, it's really quick. So there's two things. If you want to try it, you can go onto our portal, our website today, and create an account. Takes 2 seconds, no credit card, all that stuff, and just sign in with enter your Google Analytics details. And what that'll do is it will give you a 3-month retrospective on your trends within the UK, right? And what that's really interesting is you kind of see a shifting heat map of where you've had kind of influence or hotspots, if you like. Because then anyone who's done any paid advertising or marketing activity can go, well, maybe you can kind of spot the places you've been wasting money for the last 3 months, right?
So fantastic.
That's a 5-minute activity, right? And that's really just to show people the variance in a 3-month period, the variance in their traffic profile. If that's great and they go, okay, we should probably do something about this, it's super easy. You know, connect, give us your data, which is generally quite a quick job. You know, I would expect someone to be in the tool for less than an hour for setup, you know, and that's, you know, it's, well, probably less than that. Once we've given you the recommendation, you know, you see our recommendation. If you approve it, you can hit a publish to LinkedIn button and it sits in LinkedIn, or you can download it, give it to your agency, upload it to your other tools. And then monthly, you're just going through that cycle, you know, 5-10 minutes a month. It's really, really lightweight.
Wow. That sounds fantastic. Well, I didn't. And so the website. Well, we'll put all that. But we'll put a link to the website where people can sort of have a look at this tool and stuff. Now, I wanted to kind of build up to this because I think it gets to the absolute core of the benefits of AI. But I mean, essentially, you're not using, and this is the distinction that I had, and I felt like a big dumb idiot when I was first asking you, because I was like, I can't get my head around this, because you're not using online information that the competitors would be using, are you? I mean, you're using offline stuff as well. So, I mean, how do you know where my next new customers are going to be?
Yeah, and that really comes back to this branch of network science. So, you know, broadly, you know, a network is, you know, two or three things that are linked together. Okay, so the most famous examples of these are social networks that we talk about every day.
Right.
The internet is another kind of big example of a network. Now, with this science, we can predict how Facebook's going to grow. We can predict how the internet's going to grow. You know, so because they kind of grow and they have certain behaviors, right, that just exist. So by knowing those behaviors, okay, in the visible world, we can take that and look in the invisible world, right? And it sounds complicated, and fundamentally it is complicated. You know, we've kind of got, you know, academic guys.
I was going to say, you've got real boffins, haven't you?
Yeah, they've got PhDs in network science to produce this stuff. So actually, you know, that's why that gets complicated. But if we kind of bring that up to, you know, probably a friendlier level, if you like, it's really kind of, as we talked about earlier, it's really just looking for those signals. And as an example, right, if we're looking within an area, and I'm not using the word area too strictly, that doesn't mean a town.
Right.
You know, you can start to see sales that will happen in increasing frequency, right? So the first sale in an area might be really slow. Your second sale might be quicker. Third's quicker still, right? So we start to see this ramp up, and then we hit this tipping point and sales speed's really quick, right? That's an indication that kind of people are talking about you, right? Because if you think about, you know, I've recommended Asana to you today, right, and said it's a great tool. Now, if the next person on your podcast recommends Asana, you're thinking, this tool's probably really good, right? Now, the more that happens, you're going to get to a point where you buy, and everyone's going to start buying these tools really quickly. And that's kind of it. Now, the complication there is an area isn't strictly defined. So it's not like everyone in Bristol, you know, that area might be larger, and that's part of the complication, right? And that's why we have these kind of highly intelligent guys and girls who do that work. But yeah, hopefully my simple explanation was simple, but I appreciate there's a lot in there.
No, I mean, I think it's just, you know, it's remarkable, because it's a science that we don't know that much about at the moment. You know, we don't understand a sort of a general level that you know, this sort of groupthink sort of capability that the internet now gives us, I think, is quite, and that networks give us is quite interesting. And I heard you explain it a while ago when you used a phrase which I thought was fantastic, which is, you know, groups of people have a better memory than individuals, which I think is just that's just an extraordinary nice simple way to show how good networks are now these days.
Yeah, and you know what I love about that is, again, another study from the, I think it was the B2B Institute in LinkedIn this time,
right,
is they call it the 95-5 rule, right? So 95% of the time, at any given time, 95% of B2B buyers are not actually in the market to buy anything. Okay, so your job in marketing is to kind of be in their head when they are ready to buy, right? So think back to the example we talked about earlier. It's about reinforcing people's kind of memory of you. So exactly that, you know, if I don't know how many times you've sat around a table and, or, you know, whether it's sociably or at work, and someone's like, oh, what was the name of that band, or what was that name of that customer, or someone else around the table will complete it, right? The bigger the table, the more likelihood someone's going to complete it. So therefore, and I had it today, actually, I was having a coffee with someone this morning, and she was kind of saying, oh, that restaurant you recommended me, I totally forgotten the name, right? Because she had forgotten it, right? If I told it to a group of them, and we were joking about exactly this. So memory is super important. And therefore, yeah, if you can find where this group has memory about your products and show them, you know, give them those kind of prompts, you know, it's going to only end better for you.
That's fantastic. That's great. Well, that's a great explanation. Thank you, Tom. Now, just a quick diversion, but I mean, you mentioned it in conversation a while ago. Your technology, your science or whatever, has been was used to do some virus modeling for some agencies, wasn't it? So, I mean, what was that all about? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, do you know what? Linked to what you just said about, you know, we don't think about networks or don't see about networks, but right. Actually, funnily enough, we've all had the biggest lesson in network science over the last 2 years,
because absolutely. Yeah,
how viruses transmit is networks. You know, we know where transport hubs are, you know, we know how communities work. So, you know, the R number that, you know, Boris has spent the last 2 years educating us on is really about suppression. Okay, so it's the opposite of our models, if you like. What we're trying to do in the marketing context is give a message that transmits. So if you like, we're talking about an R number that's positive, right? The government, from a virus context, are trying to make an R number that's reducing. So what they've done, and this is part of what we did, was how do we identify areas that look like they've got the highest potential for virus spikes? You know, that might be in terms of household occupancy levels, that can be health levels, these sorts of things. And if you understand those areas, you can do community intervention, right, in terms of all the things we've seen over the last few years. Now, that's exactly what we do for marketing. We just flip it, right? We're in the marketing context looking for areas that have the highest propensity for growth and saying, you know, intervene there. So yeah, we just flipped it on its head, if you like. And yeah, we did some work over the pandemic while we could, just to, you know, help some help some people, help some agencies, help some businesses, do some better prediction.
Well, I mean, if I can give you a piece of advice, Tom, I'd stick with it if I was you. I'd keep that going, because I tell you, 20 odd years ago, I worked for a computer games company, and we were doing artificial intelligence built in computer in characters in games. And nice. The technology was then, though it was being investigated at that stage for its potential for military applications, for missiles, for flocking missiles and stuff like that. Yeah. And I read recently, a couple of weeks ago, that this is something that is now becoming, you know, a technology that they're embedding in, you know, in pilotless planes and stuff like that. So, you know, bear with it. It might still come in yeah. useful. So keep going with that, Tom. That's fantastic. But excellent. So, well, listen, thank you very much for kind of explaining that. And I mean, generally, outside of that, I mean, how is business going for you at the moment? I mean, is it a busy time for you right now?
Yeah, it is. And as I said, you know, we're a startup, you know, so we've taken this out of academia. We've yep. proved it with a number of kind of, you know, we've proved it with the likes of Comic Relief and the likes. So yeah, we brought this to market last year,
right.
and it's just growing. You know, we've got open headcount, which is great as a kind of business owner. You know, we can grow the team on the backs of it. And actually, we've got, which is really exciting for 2022, we've started to get some really exciting agency partnerships going, you know, with kind of some of those agencies that understand that they need to deliver their customers more, and data can be the answer, but they don't necessarily have the skills or expertise or desire, right? Because, you know, they're potentially very creative, and it's almost a partnership of mixing, you know, art and science.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's very much that. So yeah, it's been a strong start to the year, COVID aside.
Sure.
But I think that's been the world, right? So yeah, no, really excited. We're really excited for kind of what 2022 brings.
And obviously, I mean, a good part of that is the fact that you understand how agencies work and how, you know, sort of what their pain points are and what they need to be able to do. So I think that's very important, in that, you know, it's not like you're coming at it from a purely academic or scientific perspective. You do understand how agencies are built and what their drivers are. So I think it's important.
Yeah, and I think that's a really, really important point to highlight, actually. I think, you know, there's a lot of great work that happens in academia, but necessarily doesn't connect to the problem quite well, right? But the biggest thing for us was, you know, working direct with brands to understand the problems, you know, speaking to people responsible for growth in companies that have raised ridiculous amounts of money, and like, what is the problem and why is it, why hasn't the existing stuff worked, and you know, how is the value of this and how can we make that more efficient, you know? Right. So it's really, the academic stuff is great and it's a great base to show, you know, that we've put some work into this, but really you can discount that because the important stuff is how do we map that to the problem that the customer has and therefore the agencies and the rest of the kind of world has around it.
Perfect. Well, that's a nice note to end that on as well. So thanks for that, Tom. That's great stuff. And so, I mean, when you're not sort of being all sciencey and doing all this, I mean, what's your kind of favorite form of relaxing these days?
Well, I should add, I have a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old, so in between running the business and that, there's not a lot of downtime. But I guess for me, it's being outdoors. So it's, you know, whether that's on the water, like windsurfing, or whether it's in the mountains, riding my bike, or as we're going in a few weeks, now the borders are open, off to France snowboarding. You know, it's I like to get out, get some fresh air, really.
Lovely, nice stuff. Well, good for you as well. It stops you developing a figure like a croissant. But so last part of the show, we do have three things, and we've got a new feature that we're gonna debut with you as well. So I want to I don't know whether to do that. Should I do it first, or should I do it last? I don't know. Okay, let's do the first two first. The ones we all know and love. Have you got a piece of music that you would like to recommend for our listeners?
Yeah, and you know what? Music's a big part of my life, and good. You know, when I'm drinking with friends, and you know, it's the conversation that we can never end. Like, what's your favorite song, right? It's really hard to, you know, I spent many an evening, you know, with us arguing over Spotify playlists and just having a great conversation. So it's always really hard, but song I always come back to, it's by, you know, a band I grew up with, Red Hot Chili Peppers, yep. And it's called Soul to Squeeze. So it's not one of their, it's I think it was on their 2003 greatest hits. It was never on a main album. It was a B-side to their Blood Sugar Sex Magik album, but it's just a cool song. So if you like the Chillies or you don't, it's always what I always always put it on. I always recommend people to give it a go.
We'll be playing that out as your underneath all this, as your recommended track. And so why is that? What was the sort of history behind that?
Yeah, do you know what? That's what I love about music. There's always kind of, it always brings up an emotion, and you can't always remember where it came from.
Right.
Like, you know, formative years, right? The Chillies, you know, I'm we've just entered my last year of the 30s where I can cling to that piece, you know, so they were there when I was growing up. And I think it was just a song that, you know, I'm a drummer, failed drummer, obviously.
All right. Excellent.
But drums are what I played growing up, and you know, I play a big guitar, and I really enjoy it as a song. I can't really pin anything on it, but for all their stuff, it produces some good emotion. So
good,
it's
stuff.
good one to go to.
Nice one. And a favorite book that you'd recommend. It doesn't have to be a business book if you don't want to, it's up to you.
Yeah, no, I talk about this book to a lot of people, actually. It's called Quiet, the Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And it's, you know, I'm a bit of an introvert myself. You know, I've learned over the years to walk into rooms and, you know, how to power that. That's not how I get my energy, right? You know, if I have a whole day of networking or meetings or presentations, that takes it out of me. You know, I'm not a natural extrovert. And the book's really fascinating from many angles, right? From business to building good teams, right? It's not about people that just talk loudly. For parents, you know, it's really interesting. I reflected as a parent reading some of it and thought, wow, I've not recognized myself in my children. But just for humans, right? It's, you know, we all socialize, and, you know, it's easy to kind of gravitate to the kind of the loud, gregarious type sometimes. But actually, yeah, understanding the power of introverts is just fascinating. And as a book, I just think it's a really good side. Scary as well, right? Because it shows how much of the world is geared to extroverts. And actually, I think there's a hidden opportunity for a lot of businesses that, you know, make sure you're thinking about this, and you're probably going to get you know, two sides of an argument, you know, if you set your company up to listen to it, which sadly a lot don't.
Yeah, we've had this on the show before about the, you know, the sort of the power of sort of alternative thinking and sort of using people that you wouldn't think were sort of like, you know, they don't fit the typical profile of your normal extrovert. Very useful. I mean, you're one of these guys that can just, like, you're happy when you're on your own, sort of thing. You're a good worker on your own.
Yeah, my wife never gets it. Like, you know, when I'm going out, she makes sure someone comes over for dinner or comes over for drinks. When she's going out, I'm like, brilliant, I'm going to spend the night on my own. She doesn't get it, and, you know, it's funny. But she's actually reading that book at the moment. So
try and get in your head somehow. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, look, the new feature is we've introduced show and tell, where I asked you if you could bring an object in and just explain its kind of significance and meaning, and we'll see where we go for this. I don't know whether it's going to work or not, but we'll see how we get on. So what are you bringing to the show and tell?
Well, let's test it, shall we? So I am bringing a bike helmet.
Okay, that's a cool one. It's got a camera. Yeah, so it's got a camera thing on the top as well.
Do you know what? Actually, that's for a light, because like this, yeah, I go riding in the woods when it's dark and you need very powerful lights for obvious reasons. Now, the reason I bought a helmet is it's really, to me, to see, you know, I've been riding bikes since I was since I was a kid. You know, that's what I grew up doing, right, alongside sort of playing the drums. But for me, it's really important personally, but also for kind of friends and people who I work with, that life's not about work, right? And my bike stuff always reminds me that life is bigger than what you're doing at the moment. You know, I've been riding bikes for whatever, 20 years, and I'm hopefully going to ride them for another 20. And I just think it's really important. And I would speak to the guys at work about it, that we've all got lives outside of this, and it can seem really urgent that what we're doing and what we're trying to grow is important. But if we don't you know, water and nurture our interests outside of work, then it just doesn't lead to happy people in the long term. And I just think it's a thing we need to think of more, right? Our own enjoyments, and are we fulfilling ourselves personally? Because that's the only way we can bring ourselves to the job. It's not about 80 hour weeks, right? It's about coming up energized and happy. And I believe you can only do that by making sure you're kind of making that other side of your life is a priority.
Well, that does it. We're definitely keeping this feature. That was fantastic. What a great idea. What a great sort of nice philosophy on that. And I think that's a fantastic way to do that. So great, good. Thank you for bringing that on, Tom. That's fantastic. And before we go, I just want to say thank you very much for putting the time aside and coming on the show and helping us and helping me to understand, you know, the opportunity of a life without cookies, and also for doing it in such a kind of nice unsciencey way. So thank you very much. I really appreciate that. That's super.
Likewise, I appreciate having me on. I say I was looking forward to this, and yeah, it was great. It's great to talk. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Well, you can catch Tom's own podcast, which is called Data for Bluffers, on all the usual podcast platforms. Check out GD Labs. We'll put the link in the show notes on the website at www.thefuelpodcast.com. Tom's GD Labs website is gdlabs.ai. Am I right?
Correct.
Yep. Okay. And on there, you've got tons of information about how the technology works. You've also got this fantastic little tool that you can use as a nice little freebie to demo the product as well. And we'll have a link to Tom's LinkedIn profile in the show notes. And so we'll put all that in there. But meantime, Tom, thank you so much. I wish you well. Have a prosperous 22. I hope we get to stay in touch, so that one day when the ad world is paying its respects to you, and I can say, I know that guy. So all the best, Tom. Thank you very much.
Cheers,
you
Kate.
Take care.
Yeah, you too.
So So there you go. You can check off worrying about the demise of cookies now, because we've got your back. Or more accurately, Tom's got your back. Thank you, Tom, and thanks to everyone at GD Labs for designing this wonderful 21st century answer to the problem. As I like to do, I learned so much from this show, and I hope you did too. And we'll be back before you know it with another great episode. We've got a special Super Bowl edition coming up and a very special event planned for you, so don't touch that dial. If you like this show and want to know when we publish a new edition, hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. We also have a video channel on YouTube. Just search for The Advertist or follow the link in the show notes for this show at www.thefuelpodcast.com. My thanks as always to Team Fuel. That's Peter Banks, Matt Smith, Donna and Matt Bullard. Also thanks to the show's sponsor, The Advertist. I literally couldn't do it without you. I'm your grateful host, a Smith called Keith. Thank you to you and you and you for your continued support, all you lovely listeners. I look forward to you joining me next time on Fuel, the podcast for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?